Picture this. It's a Sunday morning. You're sitting in the same queue you've sat in for the last, what, 5 years? You sing the three songs, listen to the 40-minute message, shake a few hands in the lobby, and then you head home. Yeah, for pot roast. On paper, you've done everything right. You've successfully gone to church.
But internally,
Internally, you feel restless, maybe even a little bit bored. And then, you immediately feel guilty for feeling bored. You start wondering, is this it? Is this really the peak of the spiritual life?
That restlessness is exactly the starting point for the book we're covering today. And I'll say this up front. If you're totally comfortable with the status quo of modern religious life, this deep dive might make you squirm just a little.
We like a little squirming. Today, we're looking at Establishing the Ecclesia, Advancing the Kingdom of God Through Maturity by Cheryl R. Thomas. And right off the bat, I get the sense this is not just another how to improve your church service guide, is it?
Oh, not even close. This is more like a demolition manual. Thomas argues that the friction you're feeling isn't just boredom, it's a clash between two completely different operating systems.
Okay.
One is the church, which she describes as this largely man-made, often religious structure, and the other is the ecclesia, a biblically authorized legislative body of mature believers.
So she throws down the gauntlet immediately. Her premise is that we're in a transition period. She calls it the seventh day since Adam, where the old structure is literally failing so the true one can emerge.
Exactly.
So our mission for this deep dive is to map out that transition. We need to understand the difference between going to church and being the ecclesia, and then look at the roadmap she provides, which she warns is a wilderness journey, to get from one to the other.
Precisely. And to really get why she's calling for such a radical shift, we have to start with a linguistic distinction that really changes everything.
Let's start there, because church and ecclesia, I mean, they're usually treated as synonyms, right? If I open my Bible, I see the word church. But Thomas is saying we're missing something.
We are missing the entire point, according to her. She points out that the Greek word used in the New Testament is ecclesia. Now, in the culture of that time, we're talking ancient Greece and Rome, an ecclesia wasn't a religious building. It wasn't a weekly service with a choir.
So what was it?
It was a secular political term. It referred to a group of citizens who were called out of their homes to assemble and make decisions for the city. It was a legislative assembly, a ruling body.
That is a massive shift in mindset. A service is passive. I sit, I receive, I go.
Exactly. An assembly or a legislature is active. You propose, you vote, you rule.
Yeah.
Precisely. Thomas argues that Jesus didn't say, "I will build my nursery." He didn't say, "I will build my hospital," though of course healing happens. He said, "I will build my legislative assembly." And she goes pretty hard here. She suggests what we call church, often creates a culture of containment. She even uses the term Babylonian.
Whoa, Babylonian is a heavy label. That implies something counterfeit or, confusing.
And she uses it intentionally. In biblical symbolism, Babylon represents a system where man tries to reach God through his own effort, his own structure, his own hierarchy. It's a system of mixture and confusion. She's arguing that we've built these complex religious structures designed to contain God's people rather than release them to rule.
So instead of a headquarters for an army, we build a playpen.
That is a great way to put it. And she uses this specific vision to illustrate the structural problem, the Chinese lantern.
Right. Walk us through that, because when I read this part, I was trying to visualize the physics of it.
So this was a vision she had back in 1996. She
Wow.
saw a classic Chinese lantern, the paper kind with the rigid structure inside, and she gets this command, "Turn the lantern upside down."
Which structurally just doesn't work for a lantern. I mean, the flame would burn the paper, the whole thing would collapse. It wasn't designed for that.
Exactly. But the symbolism is about inversion. The lantern represents the current church structure. Turning it upside down is a total paradigm shift. And she connects this to the biblical mandate to be a city on a hill.
You are the light of the world. We've all heard that verse.
Yes, but she ties it to Mount Zion. In her theology, Zion isn't just a place in the Middle East, it's a spiritual position of maturity. It's where the one new man, that's Jew and Gentile united, rules with Jesus. And her argument is you cannot be that city on a hill using the old lantern structure. The structure itself has to flip.
Okay, but if we flip the structure, the people inside have to change too, right? You
Yeah.
can't have a legislative assembly if everyone inside still acts like they need spiritual diapers.
And that is the absolute crux of her argument. This is where the concept of maturity becomes central. Thomas says that the modern church has largely sold salvation as the final destination. You get your ticket, you wait for heaven, you're done.
And she says that is what, wrong.
Okay. Incomplete. She says it's incomplete. She argues that salvation is just the doorway. The destination is the kingdom. She uses this metaphor of milk versus honey. Milk is the basic word of God essential for babies. But honey. Honey is the revelation of the word. It's deep inside. It's for grown-ups. She's calling believers to stop being satisfied with milk and to grow up into the honey.
This makes me think of the vision she describes about the bride. That one really stood out to me because it felt almost selfish, or at least very solitary.
It is a provocative image. She sees the bride of Christ getting ready for the wedding. She's applying makeup, ironing her dress, checking for wrinkles. But the key detail is her focus. She's completely ignoring the crowd around her.
Right.
She doesn't care about their applause or their criticism. Her eyes are locked exclusively on the groom.
So it's an antidote to performing for an audience.
It is. But there's an even sharper edge to it. The bride is making herself ready. Thomas argues that ruling and reigning with Christ, being part of this ecclesia, it's not a participation trophy you get just for saying a prayer once. It's reserved for the mature, for those who overcome.
That's a challenging take. It implies there are tiers, or at least levels of authority, based on spiritual maturity. It's not a democracy where everyone gets the same vote, you know, regardless of engagement.
Exactly. And that maturity requires a specific kind of humility. There's another vision she shares that I think is the most surreal one in the book, the breathing building.
Oh, yeah. This one was wild. Describe what she saw.
She sees a church building that is literally alive. It's pulsating, expanding, and contracting like lungs. And it has these long sort of spectral arms reaching out into the community, grabbing farmers, mothers, factory workers, and placing them inside the building.
Which sounds like the ultimate evangelism machine. I mean, every pastor's dream, right?
You'd think so. But she walks into the building to see the result, and the people are gone.
Vanished.
Gone. Instead, the whole interior is filled with this blinding blue light, which she identifies as Jesus. And the message she got was this. The people had become so hidden in Christ that only he was visible.
That's almost a paradox. The ecclesia is a legislative assembly of people, but the ultimate goal is for those people to be invisible.
Invisible in terms of ego, invisible in terms of, look at me. The true ecclesia doesn't reveal how cool the pastor is or how big the congregation is. It reveals the king. If you see the people, you're missing the point.
Okay, so we have the vision, a mature ruling body that reveals Christ perfectly. But let's be real. If we look around at the landscape of modern Christianity, that's not what we typically see.
Yeah.
So what's blocking this?
Thomas identifies a very specific antagonist, and it's not the culture or politics. She says the call is coming from inside the house. The enemy is the religious spirit.
Okay, define that for us. Because religion can just be a neutral term for a belief system.
Right. In this context, she defines religion as man's attempt to get to God through rules, rituals, and control rather than through relationship. It's the checklist. It's the performance. And she brings up the biblical concept of Ichabod.
That's from the Old Testament, right? It means the glory has departed.
Exactly. She warns that you can have a building, a budget, a full band, a packed room, and still have Ichabod written right over the door. The structure is there, but the actual presence of God has left because the program took priority over the person.
She lists some characteristics of this religious spirit, craving titles, doing things for show, making rules you don't follow yourself. It's very pharisaical. But the connection she makes to apathy really caught me off guard.
It's a profound insight. She tells a story about a prayer group she was in. They were trying to, you know, do warfare against spirits of apathy, complacency, and lethargy in the church. They were yelling, rebuking, trying to wake people up.
Which is a pretty common thing in prayer circles. Lord, wake up the church.
Totally. But she realized they were just hitting a brick wall. And she understood that those spirits, apathy, and lethargy had a legal right to be there. They were symptoms, not the root cause. The root was the religious spirit.
So religion actually causes apathy.
Well, think about it. If your spiritual life is reduced to a set of repetitive rituals and obligations without a genuine encounter, what is the natural human response?
Boredom. You check out.
You check out. The system itself creates the environment where apathy thrives. You can't scream the apathy away while you're still agreeing with the religious structure that produces it.
That makes so much sense. It's like trying to cure a headache by banging your head against the wall even harder.
Yeah.
So if we're stuck in this structure, this Babylon, as she calls it, how do we get out? She doesn't paint a picture of an easy exit. She talks about the wilderness.
The wilderness is the transition zone. It's that space between the church structure and the ecclesia reality. And to explain how you enter it, she uses this amazing analogy of the eagle stripping the nest.
This is one of those nature facts that's both inspiring and kind of horrifying.
It's brutal. When a mother eagle knows it's time for her eaglets to fly, she doesn't just give them a pep talk. She starts ripping out the soft fur and the grass lining of the nest. She exposes the sharp sticks and thorns underneath.
She makes their home miserable on purpose.
She has to. If the nest stays comfortable, the babies will never leave. Thomas shares her own story here. She lost a dream job that she absolutely loved. At the time, she was rebuking the devil, thinking it was a spiritual attack. But in hindsight, she realized it was God exposing the thorns. He was making her comfortable place miserable to push her into her destiny.
She actually breaks this down into a 1-2-3 process.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a roadmap for the crisis of faith that so many people go through.
It really is. Step one is leaving the walled city. That's leaving the status quo, the man-made religion. Step two is the valley of decision. That's the wilderness, the messy middle where you're tested. And step three is the promise, the blinding light, the new land.
And she connects this to a story about $2 bills that I found. Or, honestly, a little weird at first. It felt a bit like numerology or something.
I get that skepticism.
Yeah.
But Thomas frames it as God speaking through patterns. It involves a pastor's wife working as a waitress. On February 1st, so 21, she gets two separate tips, both are $2 bills, at table one.
Okay, that's a coincidence.
Maybe. But then a month later, on March 3rd, 33, she waits on table 23 and gets two $2 bills again.
Huh. The odds are getting slimmer.
Right. And Thomas saw this as a prophetic confirmation of that transition, the move from step one through step two into step three. It was a signpost saying, you are on the right path, keep moving. It really emphasizes her point that in the wilderness, you have to learn to see God in the details because the big, loud structure isn't there anymore.
But the wilderness isn't just about reading signs. It's also dangerous. She talks about the risk of the counterfeit.
This is so crucial. When you leave the structure, you are vulnerable. She warns of a counterfeit cloud. You know, in the Bible, God leads with a cloud by day. But Thomas warns that the enemy will create a fake guidance system, something that looks spiritual and safe, but it's designed to keep you going in circles.
Why? What's the goal of the counterfeit?
To get you to settle. The wilderness is hard. It's lonely. The temptation is to find a counterfeit promised land, a new church or a new group that looks a little better than the old one, but it still operates on the same man-made control system. It's settling for a nicer version of Babylon instead of pressing through to Zion.
She shares a very visceral physical reaction she had to this, the nausea incident.
Yes. Her independent assembly decided to join a denomination. On paper, it made sense. You know, better networking, safety in numbers. But physically, she felt sick, nausea. She felt like she was returning to four walls, just as God was saying, come out. It's that kind of discernment that goes beyond logic.
And this leads to what is probably the most controversial theological statement in the whole book. She equates disobedience with witchcraft.
It's a jarring line. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. It's from 1 Samuel.
But usually when we hear witchcraft, we think spells, potions, that kind of thing. How does she apply that to a regular churchgoer?
She defines witchcraft, in its essence, as seeking control or guidance from a source other than God. So here is the hard question she poses. If you are relying on your pastor to hear God for you, is that a form of idolatry?
Oof, that hits hard.
If you need a prophet to tell you what to do because you haven't developed your own ear for God's voice, is that a form of divination? She argues that relying on others to be your spiritual mediator keeps you immature. It keeps you a child. The ecclesia is made up of people who hear the king directly.
That completely dismantles the expert culture we have in so much of Christianity. We love our celebrity pastors. We love the people who have all the answers.
And Thomas is saying, strip that away. In the wilderness, it's just you and God. And that brings us to her butterfly metaphor.
The classic transformation image.
Right. But she focuses on the cocoon phase. For a caterpillar to become a butterfly, it doesn't just grow wings, it literally dissolves into a soup of cells. The old structure has to completely disintegrate before the new one can form.
And that's the scary part. We all want the flight, but we don't want the dissolution.
Exactly. But if you refuse the dissolution, if you refuse the stripping of the nest, you remain a caterpillar. You might be a very religious caterpillar, she'd argue, but you'll never rule. You will never be the ecclesia.
To wrap this up, there's one final anecdote she shares that I think just perfectly encapsulates this whole challenge. She mentions a season where God told her not to read any end times prophecy books for 10 years.
10 years, that's a long time.
A very long time to ignore the bestseller list. So why did she have to do that?
Because she realized she had learned all her theology from men. She was just regurgitating what she had read in other people's books. God wanted to strip her of all the expert opinions so she could learn to read the Word and hear the Spirit for herself.
That is a bold challenge. It really forces the question, who taught you this?
It does. I mean, how much of what you believe is something you actually know from God, and how much is just a script you've memorized? Thomas suggests that until we can answer that question honestly, we aren't ready to rule.
Well, if you're feeling that friction in the pew, or if you feel like your nest is suddenly full of thorns right now, maybe it's not an accident. It might be the call to come out of the structure and into the ecclesia.
The journey is messy, but the destination, that maturity, is worth it.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We'll see you next time.